It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, extinction. When my kids were little, it seemed like every picture book we read was full of animals. Night after night, we'd read stories about cuddly polar bears and naughty monkeys and whole oceans full of fish. And then I'd tuck them into bed with their favorite stuffed tigers and pandas. It's almost like there's a secret curriculum to childhood, to learn the Earth's creatures and fall in love with them. And maybe that's one reason it hurts so much to see so many of those creatures going extinct. The bad news is that Earth is facing a mass extinction crisis. By the end of the century, we could lose up to half of all living species. But the good news is there are people trying to do something about it, including trying to bring lost species like passenger pigeons and even woolly mammoths back to life.
Here's my prediction. Within the next couple of years, people working on this mammoth de-extinction project will succeed in transferring one, maybe two genes into an elephant cell that's growing on a dish in a lab. And they will be rightfully proud of this achievement. It will be a fantastic advance in this of this technology.
Beth Shapiro is a de-extinction biologist. And incredible as it sounds, she really is working on bringing the woolly mammoth back to life. In her lab at the University of California, Santa Cruz, she's isolating ancient mammoth DNA. But before you start thinking Jurassic Park, it's not exactly like that. Because the idea isn't really to clone a mammoth. It's more like breeding one.
It is more similar to breeding than cloning, only in that when people think about cloning, this word conjures up images of a specific scientific technique. Do you remember when Dolly the sheep was cloned? That is the technology that people think about when we think about cloning. That technology is called somatic cell nuclear transfer. The key to using this technology in de-extinction, however, is that you need to have a cell from an animal that's still alive in order for it to work. Because there are no mammoths presently alive, we can't use somatic cell nuclear transfer, this technology that people think of when they hear the word cloning, to bring back a mammoth.
So how is a mammoth going to come back? If it's not exactly the mammoth, what is it that people are working on?
People who are interested in de-extinction are not necessarily interested in bringing an exact replica of a species that used to be extinct back to life, but instead on bringing back or engineering an individual, maybe something different from anything that's alive today, that can somehow fit back into the place that these extinct animals once lived. When a species goes extinct, it disappears from a community of organisms that are all working together. And the disappearance or the extinction of that species kind of knocks that community out of whack. And what people interested in de-extinction aim to do is to fill those niches.
So for example,
an elephant is very different from a mammoth, but an elephant and a mammoth played very similar roles in their ecosystems. We could then replace what role the mammoth played in the Arctic ecosystem with a big herbivore that somehow is similar to a mammoth, but not identical.
So you're really not talking about resurrecting the mammoths. You're talking about creating a hairy elephant?
Yes, we're talking about looking at the mammoth genome and asking, what is it about the DNA sequence of the mammoth that allowed a mammoth to live in the Arctic? And so what we have to do is change the elephant genome just a little bit so that it can survive where a mammoth once did.
You also write about there's a Russian scientist who's actually so certain that somebody's going to come up with something like a mammoth that he's busy preparing a habitat for them?
Yes, Sergei Zimov. He's a really interesting guy who has purchased a lot of land around where he works in northeastern Siberia. And he is trying to create a habitat that mammoths can live in, but also that the species that are alive today that are kind of struggling to find sufficient habitat can live in. So right now he has several different species of deer, and he has bison that he's imported from Canada, and there are wild horses that are living there. And over the course of just a few years, they've transformed this landscape from a relatively barren tundra to a pretty rich and productive grassland.
Suppose somebody did bring back the woolly mammoth or something like it. A successful species is more than just biology, right? I mean, if this species hasn't existed before, how are the first new ones going to learn how and what to eat or how to survive?
It's a great question, and it's a question that needs to be considered when a species is being considered for de-extinction. You have this first phase where you manipulate a genome or you edit a genome and you change it so that you have an individual whose genome sequence looks like the way you want it to look. Then what comes next? That individual has to be born, has to learn how to act like a mammoth, if that's what you want it to act like. If that individual is born into a family of elephants, which it probably would be, isn't it just going to learn how to be an elephant? Probably. Is that enough? Well, it depends on whether being an elephant that can survive in the Arctic is enough to fill the niche that the mammoth once filled.
So is that the reason to do this? Not just to bring back a species, but to rescue or create an entire ecosystem?
I would say that that is the reason to do it. Not to bring back a species, but to restore missing interactions on an ecosystem that might actually help the species that are alive today.
You're one of the few people doing this kind of work, working with ancient DNA. What's it like in the lab?
Well, it's actually a big pain. Ancient DNA is basically it just means DNA that's in terrible condition. The best preserved remains that we get are from the Arctic, which is why we've focused for such a long time on the big animals that used to live in the Arctic, like bison and horses and mammoth and woolly rhinos and things like that.
Have you actually gone hunting for mammoth bones, hoping to find some DNA?
Sure. I've been out both in Siberia several times, and I do most of my field work up in the Yukon Territory and in northern Alaska.
And what do you do in the lab?
What we do is we get the DNA in the form of the bone, and we take it back to the lab, and then we powder it up into a small powder, and then we incubate it with some chemicals that actually will break down all the bits of that bone that aren't DNA and wash it away, get the DNA out. And then we take that DNA and we sequence all of it. What we get back is a hard drive full of ACs, Gs, and Ts broken down into smaller fragments. So the first task is to pull all that stuff apart and figure out what's mammoth and what isn't mammoth.
So besides figuring out how to bring extinct species back, there's also the issue of which ones. I mean, let's say you were on the President's Commission for De-Extinction, if there was such a thing, tasked with coming up with a short list of species to bring back. What would some of your top candidates be?
It's a fascinating question. And, you know, I taught a class here at UC Santa Cruz a few years ago where I asked all of my students to do that. Everybody seems to have a different reason for choosing different species. Some people choose species that are just fascinating, that are really different or weird or compelling for some reason. Other people just chose species because they thought they were cool, you know? Somebody want to bring a mammoth back to life because they want to ride one.
Well, I guess I thought that was the driving force behind the new science of de-extinction. I guess I thought that what everybody wanted was to see a living passenger pigeon again, or a living mammoth again, or any of the other things that have disappeared.
Sure, if I could have the chance to see a mammoth, that would be amazing, and it would be incredible, and it would be scientifically fulfilling in some way. But I'm still not sure that that's good enough to justify the expense, both financial and ethical, of doing it.
It sounds like what you're saying is ethically, you have a real problem with the idea of one-offs. Let's create a mammoth or a saber-toothed tiger or, you know, a raptor, just so we can see what they used to look like.
Yes. Ethically, I have a problem with bringing a species that's extinct back just for the sake of looking at it and being happy that you've done it. I think if we are going to go through with de-extinction, we need to know why. There needs to be an ecologically compelling reason to bring them back, and we need to do it the right way. You can't bring back one mammoth. Elephants are highly social animals. Bringing back one mammoth is cruel.
So you'd that's have it. To bring back
a whole population.
Wow. It would be a really beautiful thing to see mammoths roaming over the Arctic tundra, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Beth Shapiro is an ecologist and evolutionary biologist, and she works on ancient DNA in her lab at the University of California at Santa Cruz. She's also got a book called How to Clone a Mammoth. Just in terms of the cool factor, resurrecting a woolly mammoth would be pretty hard to beat. But there are more urgent issues facing life on Earth. There's a major study that came out just the other day showing that many ocean animals are on the brink of disappearing And now many scientists believe we're facing a new mass extinction, what they call the sixth extinction. That's also the title of a new book from Elizabeth Colbert. She's a science writer at The New Yorker, and she stopped by our studio recently to break some bad news to Steve Paulson.
Something like a quarter of all mammals right now are threatened with extinction.
A quarter of all mammals?
Yes. It's a very, very high number, a very scary number. And one thing that I think, you know, really makes an impression on people, or should make an impression on people, is all of our very closest relatives are threatened with extinction.
You're talking about the other primates.
Imminently. Well, I'm talking about the other great apes. I'm mm-hmm. talking about orangutans, gorillas, chimps. I'm talking about bonobos. So those are our very closest relatives, and they are all endangered, in some cases, just hanging on.
But it goes way beyond that. I mean, the projections are, what, a third of all sharks and rays likely to disappear? A fifth of all reptiles? A sixth of all birds?
Well, these are not just likely to disappear. I mean, these are already, you know, on the way to extinction. And the most, you know, threatened group of all right now is amphibians, actually. Something like 40% of amphibians are classified as in danger, and there's been a real spate of extinctions. Hmm. There are just many, you know, fantastic frogs and toads that you cannot find anymore.
Oh, tell me about one of those species of frogs.
Sure. Well, the species that I begin my book with, the species is called the Panamanian golden frog. It's actually technically a toad. And it's a very, very beautiful animal. It's a very bright yellow, the color of sort of a New York City taxi cab. It's very poisonous, and they communicate with each other. They live near running water, so they don't hear very well, and they don't have a call. Many frogs call, but instead they sort of wave. So anyway, they're extinct in the wild now. You can only find them in a couple of zoos and in this special facility that was built for them in Panama, because what happened was that people realized that there was this disease that was passing through the rainforest, passing through Panama.
And this was recent, right?
It was quite recent that this happened. This was back in 2006. And it took a long time to figure out what was happening to amphibians in Central America, because one of the very weird things is that amphibians were disappearing. People were going to places that are as untouched as a place can be in the world in the 21st century, and finding that frogs that they had been monitoring for, you know, years were suddenly gone.
And so this is not a case of humans clearing the rainforest and the
right.
amphibians disappearing.
Exactly. So there was a lot of controversy. There was a lot of head scratching. And eventually people figured out that a fungal disease was passing through, and you could watch that disease move. But what happened was, before they could build this facility, they started to notice that frogs were dying. And so literally, these frogs ended up being put up in a hotel.
The way you talk about this, it's almost as if the scientists who are dedicated to trying to save these species, they're setting up these little, what are the equivalent of Noah's Arks? You know, these little
right.
repositories
oh,
of trying
absolutely.
To get a few breeding animals that can carry on the species.
Yes, and more species. And I can go down a list of animals I have seen, you know, personally, that are one of, let's say, there's 100 left in the world, there's 200 left. And, you know, one of the questions that comes up in that, whether there's ever any possibility that they can repopulate the wild, is a very, very open question.
So we've already talked about the cause of at least a certain class of species that are going extinct, this fungus that is,
right.
is wiping out a lot of frog populations, for instance. What are other causes of extinction?
Well, this fungal disease is emblematic of a bigger problem, which is that we're moving species around the world. So that fungus was probably moved around the world, you know, by people.
Inadvertently.
And now it's everywhere. And you hear about this all the time, right? You know, there are zebra mussels, there are Asian carp, all these things that could potentially wipe out native species. So that's one driver of extinction, bringing together things that are deadly for each other.
What about climate change? Is that having much of an impact on extinction rates?
Well, climate change is the big looming threat. We can certainly see a lot of species that are on the move. So if the climate's warming, you need to move, right, either to a higher latitude or a higher elevation to try to, you know, keep in your climate range.
Now, one of the revelations I had reading your book was the impact that climate change is having on oceans. I mean, with these greater levels of carbon dioxide, it's having a huge effect, especially on coral reefs.
Yeah, I think one of the great underreported stories of our time, really, to be frank, is what's happening to the oceans. And all you really need to understand this phenomenon is that when you pump a lot of CO2 into the air, as we're doing, a lot of it ends up very quickly getting dissolved in the upper layers of the ocean. And when CO2 dissolves in water, it forms an acid, carbonic acid. The ocean is becoming more acidified.
So what happens then to species in the ocean?
Any number of things could happen, right? The one that is pretty predictable, it becomes more difficult for any animal that builds a shell or an external skeleton out of calcium carbonate. So corals, any coral reef, all they're doing is, you know, assembling calcium carbonate. That is what a coral reef is. It's a lot of calcium carbonate. And there are very, very few scientists who say that, you know, if we continue to dump CO2 into the air and effectively into the water, that coral reefs will live out this century, okay?
Wow. You mean all the coral reefs in the world could disappear this century?
Yes. Yes. And I think people need really to be aware of that.
And a coral reef has one of the richest collections of biodiversity in the world, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's something called the rainforests of the oceans. And you know, in the process of reporting that book, I went to both a rainforest, the Amazon rainforest, and to the Great Barrier Reef.
In Australia.
Yeah. And I can tell you that the amount of life and the abundance of life and the diversity of life that you see on the Great Barrier Reef is really unequaled anywhere in the world. It is so extraordinary. You feel like you're in a dream landscape.
Tell me, you have this great description of what it was like to go there, and especially walking around at night on a little island on the Great Barrier Reef, which sounds like an amazing experience.
Yeah, I went to this little tiny island called One Tree Island, which it was just this bit of reef that had sort of been thrown up above the waterline by a big, big storm a couple thousand years ago. So the scientists I was with were doing an experiment that required you to walk out about a mile on the reef. You could only do it at low tide, otherwise you'd drown. And we would go out in the middle of the night. I would go out with them sometimes, and it was just a spectacular, sometimes rather hair-raising experience. And life, even in the pitch black, where you only have a flashlight beam in front of you, is extraordinary. You know, we would see octopuses and these amazing giant clams that live in the Great Barrier Reef.
You said you sort of had to, like, step over the clams, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, when I say giant, I mean giant. They're the size of not quite a bicycle tire, but very, very big.
Wow. So you were just walking along and seeing this whole incredible array of big animals below you.
Yes. And when you go out during, you know, we would go snorkeling sometimes when the scientists weren't working, when it was high tide. That is when you really see, you know, you just are looking down onto the reef and the assemblage of fish, just the extraordinary shapes and colors, and then followed by tuna, who are followed by sharks, and rays, these incredibly very graceful, beautiful manta rays.
So did working in this project, writing this book, did this leave you really depressed?
It had two impacts simultaneously. To have more and more appreciation for the extraordinariness of life on Earth and the remarkable ways that so many different species have found to survive. And on the other hand, an extraordinary sadness. It's just in sort of unspeakable losses that's happening that will be definitely the most lasting legacy of humanity. Certainly, if we're going to do anything about it, we certainly need to be aware of it.
Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer at The New Yorker. She talked with Steve about her book, The Sixth Extinction. Coming up, the story of the heroic quest to capture the first recording of one of the world's most elusive species, the ivory-billed woodpecker. Also, the story of how grizzly bears taught a traumatized Vietnam vet how to heal. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International. So there's a bird that's kind of a holy grail for hardcore birders, the ivory-billed woodpecker. Like the Loch Ness Monster, it's not even supposed to exist. It's been labeled extinct for 150 years, except every few decades, somebody spots one. And one sighting in 1932 launched an epic expedition to find, photograph, and capture the first ever recording of the rare bird. Greg Ely has the story.
It's 1935, and Jim Tanner is wading through a Louisiana swamp looking for an ivory-billed woodpecker. He's part of an expedition from the Cornell Ornithology Lab to record the calls of America's rare birds. And the ivory bill is the rarest. In fact, just a few years earlier, most people thought the country's largest woodpecker was extinct. So when a Louisiana legislator walked into the state game office and asked for a permit to shoot one, they humored him. A few days later, he triumphantly displayed his trophy, with a scarlet crest and white beak. It was a male ivory bill. Word spread quickly among birders, whose outrage at the kill was matched by their optimism. The ivory bill was still out there. At Cornell, they hatched a plan. The head of the lab, Doc Allen, convinced the American Museum of Natural History to fund the trip by promising to record a variety of bird calls. But the ivory bill was the main target. Paul Kellogg loaded a truck with 1,500 pounds of recording gear and microphones, many of which he designed himself. Jim Tanner, a promising grad student, went along to help out. He was 21 years old and kept a diary throughout the trip.
Wednesday, February 13th. Left Doc's house at 9:15 a.m. Paul and Mrs. Kellogg in a little rush. Doc and I in big. Good day for driving. Roads are clear and a nice sunset. Arrived in Washington at 9:30 p.m. Ambassador Hotel.
They head south toward the spot where the ivory bill had been shot. It's a plot of Louisiana forest owned by the Singer Company, whose plan is to one day turn the trees into sewing machine cabinets. The recording truck is too heavy for the swampy roads, so they unpack the gear and transfer it to a wooden cart. They enlist a local farmer and his two mules, who lead the cart toward the interior, where they hope the ivory bills are waiting. The first few days, nothing.
Friday, April 5th. Went out looking for ivory bills, but had no luck all day. We heard several turkeys gobble, slapped at many mosquitoes, felt a bit discouraged in the evening, but figured we would find them soon.
The very next day, with the men spread out across the swamp, they hear a female ivory bill and follow her calls to a large stump. There's a woodpecker hole in the middle.
Then the male suddenly appeared and flew into the nest hole. He clamped on the lower part of the nest hole with his feet. He looked around. His big white bill and white eye were in stark contrast to his black face. The crest was long and scarlet, and every one of us had his eyes glued on the bird.
There's laughter in camp that night, some of it at the expense of Paul Kellogg, who missed the sighting while he was working on the recording equipment. They found the bird, but they still needed what they came for. They needed to record it. 2 days later, after taking pictures of the birds and studying them in their habitat, they start moving the equipment toward the nest.
While we were resting the mules, I heard a kint south of the road and followed it. It called some more, and once I saw it fly, it sounded as though two birds were talking, and right near there we found a hole high in a tree. Without much trouble, we took the wagon in, and soon after that, Paul had the apparatus set up.
That was the first, and possibly the last, recording of an ivory-billed woodpecker. Those few days in Louisiana launched Tanner's life's work, defending the bird and its habitat. He went back to the swamp for the next 3 years to study the birds and wrote the definitive book on the ivory bill. He fought against the logging of those Louisiana woods and lost. Jim Tanner died in 1991, having last seen an ivory bill in 1939.
Craig Ely brought us that story. In the last 10 years, there have been two other reported sightings of an ivory-billed woodpecker, but despite extensive searches and surveillance, neither could be confirmed. So to date, the best documentation remains what Jim Tanner found back in the 1930s. One species that's not on the endangered list is grizzly bears, but their habitats are shrinking. And 40 years ago, one man emerged as a kind of savior of grizzlies. His name is Doug Peacock, and in wilderness circles, he's a legend. He's a Vietnam vet who was so traumatized by the war that when he got back home, he couldn't handle daily life. So he escaped into the wilderness. And when he was camping out in Yellowstone, he had his first brush with a grizzly. It changed his life. In fact, over the past decades, grizzlies have become so deeply embedded into Peacock's life that he even dreams about them.
One of my types of dreams is there's a mother grizzly out there, and she's got a bear cub, but the other cub is my daughter, crawling along on all fours. But I'm worried about my daughter. Sometimes my grizzlies are not quite natural. They're just distorted just a bit, and they can take on the specter of legend and of fear. You know, the bear and I, we have a relationship. We're not talking, but, you know, I know when it's dangerous and when it's not dangerous.
Doug Peacock's a natural history buff, and he's puzzled over one of the great mysteries in the history of extinction. Why did the giant mammals that once roamed North America disappear some 10,000 years ago? We're talking about huge lions and mammoths, the saber-toothed tiger, and most fearsome of all, he told Steve Paulson, the giant short-faced bear.
This is an animal that averaged well over a ton. The bigger specimens measure 7 feet at the hip. Standing up would have been a 15-foot bear. And this bear is a pure carnivore.
You're talking about a bear that's twice as big as the grizzly of today.
Easily twice as big as grizzlies today. And that basically precluded humans hunting big game. Now, anybody coming out of the Arctic, you know, 30 or 15,000 years ago, would have been a big game hunter. It's the only way you can survive an Arctic winter. But as they went south and they ran into especially the short-faced bear, they couldn't secure a kill. But the short-faced bear had a lot of company. We had lions on this continent that were the same genus as the African lion, but twice as big. Also, we had saber-tooths. We had an American cheetah that's twice as big as the African one.
You know, one thing that seems to have happened is once these ancient ancestors, these old humans, invented the Clovis spear point, everything changed. I mean, it was the revolutionary technology where suddenly they could bring down a mammoth, and they were dangerous at that point.
That's true. It's, you know, the first of a long line of iconic American inventions. You know, it was the fluted, deadly 6-inch Clovis spear point, you know, as beautiful and sleek as a Patriot missile. We know nothing of these people except their material culture, pretty much. They seem to show up everywhere. Within 100 years, you find this iconic mammoth hunting projectile point from New York to Panama, from Washington State to Florida. And within a period of 300 years, the Clovis people and the animals they hunted went extinct and were gone.
And that's one of the greatest mysteries in human history.
Truly,
in this relatively short period, all of these huge beasts that you were describing, they were all gone in a fairly short period of time. And that time seemed to correspond to when the Clovis people were around.
That's exactly true. And at the same time, we had our global warming that started about 14.7 thousand years ago. And that, no doubt, started to fragment habitats. You know?
Well, I mean, you're raising two possibilities as to what may have caused all of these huge animals to go extinct. It was global warming at that point, you know, the earlier version of global warming, or maybe these ancient humans hunted them into extinction.
I don't think either one quite stands up by itself. Human beings certainly didn't kill off all of those animals when Clovis showed up, because those animals were on the decline and moving around a lot, 14,000 years ago. The habitat is being fragmented, but it really very much looks like the coup de grace was hunting by humans and probably the Clovis hunters.
Doug, I know one of the reasons why you're so fascinated by this history is you have been for decades kind of entranced by what it's like to live alongside a top predator. I mean, for you, it's been the grizzly bear. You've lived among them for decades now. And you have said that the psychic landscape changes once you are in their presence. Once you're in the presence of an animal that could easily kill you if it so chose to.
It does transform the psychic landscape like nothing else can. You know, you take your Kelpie pack and you hike in the High Sierras or anywhere in Colorado, and you're top dog, you walked on the trail, and you can be thinking about your girlfriend or your portfolio or something else, but, you know, you added a grizzly bear to that equation, you're not the top of the food chain, and you necessarily start looking around, and you smell better, you hear better. And, you know, I don't use trails. I've been chasing grizzlies now, well, it's 45 years or a little more. And I also fight to protect them, too, because in a way they saved my life when I came back from Vietnam, because what I needed after two tours as a Green Beret medic in Vietnam was to get out of myself. You know, the last thing I needed was self-indulgence. And when you enter grizzly country, where you're living with an animal that if it chooses could kill and eat you anytime it wants to, self-indulgence is just utterly impossible.
Well, and to put this in context, you just come back from Vietnam, you were a Green Beret medic. You were pretty shattered, weren't you, by what you saw?
I was there through the Tet Offensive, and the short story is I was responsible for, handled, and saw too many dead children. It was too much at the end. You know, I had gone sort of native by then in Vietnam, and the command knew it. They ordered me out of the field, choppered me out. I was way up in the Central Highlands in Quang Nai Province. We flew out to the coast. On my last day in the field in Vietnam, we got shot at, which is no big deal. You get shot at in a helicopter all the time. But I looked at the map, and I said, oh, yeah, I know this place. I've been on the ground there. It was My Lai.
And but you flew over during
well,
the My Lai Massacre?
Well, it was happening March 16th, the morning of March 16th, 1968. A year later, I saw those pictures in Life magazine. Those pictures changed my life forever. You know, I was never going to be a candidate for reentering society, and I haven't yet.
So you landed back in America. You landed out in the woods,
in the
wilderness.
I camped out for several years, literally, truly.
Why was that so healing for you, that experience?
Basically, it was because of the grizzlies. I couldn't be around people. The one place I've always been comfortable in my life is in wilderness. You know, I was raised that way. And so, you know, I found myself camping out in the Rocky Mountains. And so one day I'm in this little tiny hot creek, which isn't very big. But here I am soaking in this hot spring in Yellowstone after the war. I look off to the side. Across the meadow, about 200 feet away, was a mother grizzly and two yearlings. I didn't know anything about grizzlies then, except you weren't supposed to be around mothers with cubs. So I decided I was going to climb a tree. So she turned, and I stood up. And, you know, the whirlpool-like effect of on my brain, all the hot water caused me to black out. But I was terrified, and so I grabbed this tree head-on, bashed it with my head, cut a huge gash in my forehead. Blood's pouring down my eyes, but I'm still so scared. I climb up to the top of this lodgepole pine tree, and it's cold. It's 40 degrees, and it's October, and the wind is blowing like hell. And I get to the top of this tree, and I find out that it's not much bigger than a Christmas tree. So anyway, this mother grizzly and her two-yearling, they graze in the area for 40 minutes. They come within 20 feet of me. They never look up. They know I'm there. They just ignore me. And I'm sitting up there like some kind of silly bird, you know, blue from cold, bleeding. Those bears got my attention. They got my attention.
They did more than that. They changed your life, it sounds like.
Well, they did. They did because I'm a critic of our society. And that's what I think a writer has to be. And I inherited that from my old friend and mentor, Edward Abbey. And, you know, the easiest exit from culture is wilderness. You go up in wilderness, and after 3 or 4 days, something happens, and you're free of culture. And you're able to look back upon your own kind and your own ways with an objective mind that's free of judgment. You know, you add a grizzly bear to that occasion, and that's what allowed me to, you know, regather the elements of my own humanity. You know, those grizzly bears saved my life. I wouldn't have had children if I hadn't been, you know, humanized in a bit by having to watch the great grizzly. And the great lessons of grizzly bears are actually lessons of tolerance, lessons of restraint.
Grizzlies are also pretty dangerous. I mean, did you have any close encounters?
Oh, yeah. I've been charged over 30 times, almost always mothers with cubs. It was always my fault. During the day when it's hot, grizzlies sleep on day beds, and they really sack out. So you can get closer than you want to be to a mother grizzly. And in the early days, I wasn't quite as astute at discerning where these day beds were going to be, and I got too close a number of times. When a grizzly's charging me, I turn my head off to the side, because that's what bears do to one another, and I hold my arms out, and I'll talk gently. I don't think it matters what you say so much as how you say it, and I don't move a muscle. And one of those mother grizzlies charged all the way, and about 6 feet away, skidded on her heels. She came so close to me, she leaned forward and sniffed my pant leg. And then after about 3 seconds, maybe four, it seemed like an eternity, but it wasn't very long, she just turned around, spun, and ran off, you know. So that's happened. It's happened a lot of times to me. And
were you terrified?
Not during those moments. A fear of bears is healthy. But I have bear dreams all the time, and my guess is that I work out my fear of grizzlies in my dreams. You know, I understand bears. I have relationships with a few individual grizzlies. There are dangerous bears, and I'm very careful around them. You really got to pay attention.
That's Doug Peacock talking with Steve Paulson. He's the author of Grizzly Years and In the Shadow of the Sabretooth. He was the inspiration for the character Hayduke in Edward Abbey's eco-classic, The Monkey Wrench Gang. You can hear him talk about their friendship and about the grizzly he calls his Moby Dick Bear in the uncut interview, which you can find on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, more about Edward Abbey and another great writer of the American West, Wallace Stegner. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
My name is Michael C. Moore. I'm a professor of energy economics at the Cornell Energy Institute and the School of Public Policy in Calgary, Canada. My dangerous idea is that water is a scarce resource that is underpriced and undervalued and ought to be taxed in order to change behavior, both in terms of the biggest water users in agriculture and in urban areas, but also to let the politicians and policymakers understand that the drought we face and the change in climate conditions is real and likely to be permanent. If we don't get a grip on where we're going with water use, no amount of rationing and no amount of conservation will help, because you can't conserve what you don't have. Right now, what we do is to assign water rights in very big blocks. For instance, thanks to the mining era in the 1800s, we have a rule that's called first in time, first in right. And that means that those who were there first, or those who were further upstream, have the first claim on water. It's not rationed, it's not priced, and it's not metered. And as a consequence, historic water uses, which were established long before cities, were allowed to use as much water as they wanted and whenever they wanted. No matter what the climatic conditions were, they could get it first. The idea is to look at the amount of water that's used to grow crops, especially those that are exported, and imagine that those that have the highest value don't always conserve the most water. In other words, we ship a lot of the water that we have in the state or in the West out to other places, and in return we get revenue, but we don't get more water back. So if we put a tax on that water use and on the water contained in those commodities, then we can begin to create a revenue source for water improvement or for conservation techniques, and we can also enforce a behavior change that says maybe all the high-value crops that we are shipping out aren't the best use of water in the state.
That's a dangerous idea from listener Michael Charles Moore. I don't know if there's any other region of the U.S. that's been as mythologized and idealized as the American West. I mean, no matter how many stories we read about drought and fire and floods, the West is still, at least in our imagination, the land of possibility and personal freedom.
The land buckles and rises. For 1,000 miles it rolls out, sometimes up and down and sometimes flat like a carpet, all the way from the old crumbling eastern mountains. But then comes a kink in the carpet, a big kink. The continent lifts itself up, its back rising, and most Homo sapiens who are seeing that lift for the first or second or even the 53rd time feel a corresponding lift in their chests, a feeling of possibility, of risk, of excitement.
David Gessner is an environmental writer and editor, and he recently took a road trip through the American West in the footsteps of two great Western writers and environmentalists, Edward Abbey and Wallace Stegner. He's written a dual biography plus memoir called All the Wild That Remains, and it begins with the story of how Gessner himself first went west, an experience that divided his life into a before and an after.
The before was New England, where I didn't even know that I was living under this kind of suppressed, heavy weight of SAT scores and Ivy League colleges and my hometown of Worcester, Mass. And the after was moving to Colorado and kind of suddenly feeling like I'd found my lost tribe, people who were outdoors all the time and just these stunning places. And also, that was the moment in my life where I was, on the week before my 30th birthday, I was operated on for a testicular cancer. Mm. So I was healing, literally healing and coming back to health as I moved to the mountains.
So you went back recently and set out on this quest to uncover and get closer to the two classic writers of the American Western landscape, Edward Abbey and Wallace Stegner. Why did you take on this particular project?
Well, when I moved west, I became what Bernard DeVoto, when he moved from Utah to Massachusetts, he called himself an apprentice Easterner. And I became an apprentice Westerner that fall. And of course, like so many readers who move west, I read Desert Solitaire, Edward Abbey's great Walden-like book, where he celebrates kind of the joys of loafing, where he says things like, I am here not only to evade for a while the clamor and filth and confusion of the cultural apparatus, but also to confront immediately and directly, if possible, the bare bones of existence, the elemental and fundamental, the bedrock which sustains us. Mm. So I'm reading this book, and it proves kind of a gateway drug to Wallace Stegner. Very different writer, very big picture, cerebral writer. You know, if Abbey's kind of the guts and balls of the operation, Stegner's the brains.
To somebody who's never heard, really, of Edward Abbey or Wallace Stegner.
Yep, yep.
Why read either of them?
Okay. When I was in Boulder, people would read The Monkey Wrench Gang, which is about, for people who don't know, basically environmental sabotage, a little gang that gets together and chainsaws down billboards and puts sugar in gas tanks and causes trouble, basically trying to stop progress and the despoiling of the land. So when I was in Boulder, people would read that book and I'd say, this is real literary influence at work, because they'd be out the next day putting sugar in gas tanks. And, I mean, it was this, it was kind of like a Hunter Thompson kind of buzz of that sort of reading.
Well, so that's the book. That's the book that inspired Earth First and some
exactly.
of the other eco-warrior groups.
Yeah. I mean, we can even do a lineage down to Whale Wars today, you know, and things like that. But so that book has that influence. Meanwhile, Desert Solitaire does something completely different. It makes you kind of want to say, screw normal life, I'm going to live this counter life. It's like a modern Walden with jokes in it and whoopee cushions. I mean, there's silliness to the book. But then it makes you want to get out there. So that's that appeal. And I think Stegner, you know, is, well, first of all, it's easy to kind of peg these guys as advocates and environmentalists. And what we have to remember is both of them still had the kind of Hemingway ideal of, you know, the great American novel. They wanted to be writers first and foremost. Though Stegner would admit that his writing came first and he kind of did his environmentalism on fumes. But on fumes, he wrote the basic text for the Wilderness Act. He came in with Kennedy. He saved all this land. So he did amazing things on fumes. So he was a brilliant writer who was also a brilliant teacher at Stanford, who taught Ken Kesey and Ed Abbey and Larry McMurtry. And then he had this, on top of all that, this kind of great environmental conscience and gave people a language to talk about the West with.
So he's one of the writers who helped us define what it means to be Western or a Westerner.
He did, and he did it in part by ripping apart the kind of rugged individualist cowboy cliche, which he abhorred, because he really saw in Native Americans and to some degree in the Mormons, people who'd successfully lived in the land by sharing and cooperation rather than, you know, claiming, oh, I'm going to do it on my own. In fact, he thought it was the dumbest place in the world to do stuff on your own.
In the meantime, the West has become a very different place. I mean, Abbey and Stegner died in 1989 and 93, and the West today, you know, is a place of drought and forest fires and fracking and other kinds of mining. Are Stegner and Abbey still even relevant to what the Western landscape has become?
Well, I won't correct you, but I will put on my Stegner hat, and he would say in response to what you said, the West has always been that place. You know, the cycles of drought have always been there. He would say, look down at this landscape from a plane and you'll see the dryness. And you'll also see the equivalent of fracking. You didn't see fracking itself, but whether it's been gold or uranium or tourism, there's always what Stegner was the first to describe as that kind of boomer mentality.
So you went out to the West basically to try to get under their skin. I mean, you're a writer and you adore their works and you could have just stopped there, but you wanted to be in the places they had been. What surprised you?
What surprised me about the landscape was I was giving a talk in Portland and a young environmentalist said, aren't you so depressed when you go out there? You know what climate change is doing to the Southwest, you know about snowmelt, you know, don't you get depressed? And I kind of looked at him and thought, no, I don't. You know, I can have those thoughts and hold them in one part of my mind and just physically enjoy being out in the landscape. And to me, that translates to the environmental world. It's, yes, we are in bad, bad shape. Yes, all these things could come true and, you know, we should fight against them as hard as we can. But on the other hand, if we just become these dour fighters, what are we left with? I mean, we still have to revel and take joy. And I think that's one reason to read Abbey still is he's got a great line. He said, enough with saving the world. Let's go down the river.
They died, Abbey in 89 and Stegner in 93. And their deaths were in some ways so characteristic of each of them.
Abbey, his last few years, even though he died, I say, at the young but also immature, in his case, age of 62. But he was sick for the last few years, and he was very brave about it. He didn't tell people. He didn't want to, you know, he kind of kept it to himself. And when he finally died, he had vowed not to die in a hospital. So they kind of hustled him out of the hospital, his friends and his wife, Clark, and they brought him out in nature to die. And the kind of punchline is they brought him out into the wilderness, and he got better. So he ended up going home, and they put him in his writing shack, and he gradually died over the next day or so. But then when he died, the famous stories begin. Peacock, Loeffler, and others took him on his final camping trip illegally out into the middle of nowhere, buried him on an unmarked grave, climbed down into the grave to try it out for fit, you know, before they put him in it, poured beer down into the grave and, you know, and buried him out in the middle of nowhere. And the epitaph on the grave was no comment. So that was Abbey's and Stegner's.
That's so mythic. And the fact that nobody knows where the grave is, it's almost as though you can imagine he didn't die. His spirit is still wandering the desert as some kind of immortal out there.
Exactly. And they also had in arches. And down in Tucson, they had these big wakes. And Abbey in his journal had left kind of stage directions. Like, he didn't want a lot of readings or dour stuff. He wanted a lot of eating and drinking and partying. And so they had these giant wakes after he died, you know, because there was no funeral. And Stegner's was quite different. By the end, he was kind of this elder of the Western community. I joke in the book that he, you know, he'd have his face on the Mount Rushmore of Western writers. And Abbey probably would, too. But he was down doing a reading in Santa Fe, and he pulled out onto the on-ramp. But he was 80, you know, in his 80s, and hit by another car. And his wife was with him, Mary, which is also characteristic. And in the hospital, he said to her, "I'm sorry, it was my fault," you know, and taking responsibility to the end. And then I said at the end of the book that the most haunting thing for me wasn't so much the death, you know, he'd had a good long life. It's what Mary found when she got home, because there was a unfinished to-do list on Stegner's desk, and he was all about responsibility. And I think, you know, I end the book on a note of saying that list is for all of us, and there's still a lot of items that aren't checked off that we've got to work to check off. Mm-hmm. We writers and environmentalists who've come after him.
David Gessner is an environmental writer and editor. His new book is called All the Wild That Remains: Edward Abbey, Wallace Stegner, and the American West. That's it for our show today, but there's more in our podcast feed. Just look for To the Best of Our Knowledge on Stitcher or iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to leave a review, because that helps other people find the show. And plus, we always like knowing what you think. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Craig Ely, Raymond Tungekar, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.